everybody, and welcome back to the Enterprise Dish. Good buddy Nick, who is up in the Seattle area, and it looks like it's actually sunny there today.
It is actually. It's a beautiful day. I think we may crack 70 degrees Fahrenheit, Ooh. Which is, I think that's low 20s centigrade. Yeah. I unfortunately have lost my ability to do centigrade to Fahrenheit conversion.
I'm
going to
give you a top tip here. So okay. 28 degrees centigrade yep. is 82 Fahrenheit. So when
that
I do
an arbitrary two arbitrary numbers to remember, but okay.
But they're inverse. So that's so when I try to do.
Oh, I got it. Oh, yeah. 2882.
Yeah.
I like it. The only one that I remember is that negative 40 centigrade.
That's
is
the other one.
Fahrenheit.
But whenever I'm trying to like ballpark it, like what's the temperature outside, I always remember that. And so, there you go. We should just end it here. That's a high note.
That's a great episode. In the can. Let's go.
See you later, everybody. But another top tip for everybody else who's listening. So we're talking migrations. We've talked Microsoft 365. We've talked about getting that stuff out onto your estate, as I'm stealing that word from Mr. Nick. But one of the things that's always going to come up is people are going to say, Nick, I've got this app. And it could be a custom line of business application. It could be whatever. And these things are not uncommon, right? Everybody's got their own. People are in business based on their custom apps. Nick, if somebody has an app problem, what do they do?
Yeah, so I think if folks listen to the second episode of Enterprise Dish, one thing that we kind of talked about towards the end is we kind of acknowledged the complexity of migrating to Microsoft 365. And you asked the question about talking about how XP to 7 was a bit of a harrowing task for many people, but 7 to 10 is much more of us. I think you said it was sliding in. You were sliding in from 7 to 10, which was a good visual. You were probably maybe thinking of baseball.
I was.
I was actually thinking like a giant slip and slide or something like that. I like that image. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah, so application compatibility. And so one of the reasons why XP to 7 was quite harrowing was around compatibility. App compatibility was an issue. Driver compatibility was a kind of a massive issue. We feel very confident, and we can kind of back it up with data, that the transition from 7 to 10 from a compatibility perspective is nothing like XP to 7, and that the vast majority of customers and therefore the vast majority of the apps and the drivers that they have in their estate are fully compatible with Windows 10. But we do acknowledge that there are scenarios where there either are compatibility issues or there sort of appear to be compatibility issues. And appearance sort of means that a great example might be that a customer might, as part of their standard kind of deployment and management practices, they might deploy a non-current version of an app. So maybe for whatever reason, they're deploying a version of, let's pick on PDF Reader, WPDF Reader.
Okay.
Let's pick on PDF Reader and say that for whatever reason, the IT team have chosen to distribute to their endpoints an older version, and that version has a compatibility issue. I don't know what it would be. Let's just say that the colors are inverted or something.
Sure,
because there's some funky thing, and so we call that sort of a perceived compatibility issue because there is a new version. A current version of that app that is fully compatible with Windows 10. And so, yes, that particular dot version may have some issues, but simply moving to the latest version of the app resolves that. And so part of that is kind of working with customers and helping them identify where they may have a dependency on an outdated version of an app, and then helping them find the latest version and then kind of incorporating that latest version into their kind of deployment management kind of strategy. But then there are actual compatibility issues. And so we have created a program. It was announced maybe 12 months ago. I've kind of lost track of time, but we call that Desktop App Assure, or Assure with my American accents. And really the Desktop App Assure or Assure program is it's a really interesting set of engineers who are inside a team at Microsoft we call Fast Track. And Fast Track is a group of folks that are all part of Brad Anderson's world, and their sole reason for being is to help deploy customers and help overcome any technical hurdles that they may have. And so one of the programs that they run under Fast Track is called Desktop App Assure, and it's a very simple promise. The promise of the Desktop App Assure program is that if you have an app compatibility issue or a perceived app compatibility issue, come to us, we'll fix it. And that's it. That's what they do. And so they have customers that come to us and they say, okay, we're blocked from deploying Windows 7, or we're blocked from migrating to Office 365 because of this thing. And they give that thing, whatever it happens to be, to the App Assure program. And the App Assure program basically does some analysis, and they come back and they give you a solution. And the solution can be all the way from that example that I just made of, hey, did you know there's actually a newer version of this app that's fully compatible? You don't have to worry about anything. And the customer goes, oh, wow, we didn't know that. Thank you so much. And we'll kind of move there. Through to doing some basic things that they call shimming, S-H-I-M, shimming. And I'm not an expert in shimming. But what I understand is that it sort of is about creating like a very light wrapper around the app that, do you remember back in the XP to 7 days, there was a, and it could actually still be in Windows 10, I'm just ignorant of it, there was a way to kind of mask the, you could kind of like right click the app and you could say like run this in Windows XP.
That still exists.
Yeah. And so, again, I'm not an expert in shimming, so think of this as like a very loose paraphrasing of what it does, but it creates like a very light layer around the app that kind of just helps to resolve some of those issues. So an app may be hard-coded to look for an OS version that starts with 6. And so if you're not running, and I'm making that up, right? But if you're not running that, then a shimming is just like a very light way of making the app think that it's running on an OS version that has 6. Or it's just fixing maybe some weird kind of flag in the registry or something. So there's these kind of light things that team can do. They call that shimming. Again, not an expert. I hope that analogy was at least kind of partially accurate, but feel free to correct me via Brad in the tweets. But then the other cool thing that this team does is if there's not a new version, if shimming doesn't work, they will actually help you rewrite the app. And if you don't have the source code, they will actually help you engineer a new version and a new solution to kind of get that app working. They have a commitment that really says that we're not going to leave any of our customers behind. To the extent that if you have an app that worked on Windows 7, does not work on Windows 10, and we can't fix it via a new version or via a shim or some other kind of light technique like that, they will help you open up the source code and modify the source, or they'll even go so far as to kind of help you, come up with some other, quite labor-intensive and kind of involved way of kind of getting you resolved. And so what this all means is that, and from our perspective at Microsoft, we feel very good that every customer should have now a path to get to Windows 10, because compatibility with apps, and it's not just Windows 7 to 10, it's also for Office Perpetual to Office 365. So if you have an Office add-on or an Office macro that you're dependent of, and macros is a really interesting one, right? Because a lot of finance teams, a lot of accounting teams, accounts payable, that kind of stuff, they are heavily dependent on macros. Macros can save a lot of time, and there can be a lot of workflows that are dependent on a macro. This team will also help resolve that stuff too. So we feel very confident in saying to our customers now, through this Desktop App Assure program, you have an assurance, and it's really why it's in the name, you should feel confident that we're giving you an assurance that we will support you in that transition to the point where if you have an app that doesn't work, we'll find that solution for you all the way through to opening up the source code and helping you modify it. So that's called Desktop App Assure. And it's a really, it's actually not very well known. I think there's a lot of customers out there that haven't heard about it. And that's not intentional. We want all our customers to know about it. And so I really would say that if you have an issue, look up Desktop App Assure through the Fast Track program and engage with them, and they will be more than happy to help you.
Through all of what you just said, I think it distills down to you don't have to go at this alone. There are resources available, and Microsoft is genuinely invested in making sure that your transition is possible and that you don't have those major barriers that are holding you back.
Absolutely. And actually, I just, as we were talking there, I pulled up some stats here. So the App Assure program, I think, has been running for about a year. And through that, through all the customer engagements they've had in that year, they have basically looked at, admittedly at scale, this is not an individual level, but over 250,000 apps.
Oh,
so
wow.
Of all the customers that have come to them and said, hey, we have a problem, or we kind of think we have a problem, can you help out? They have seen, or they've kind of, you know, identified and kind of passed to some degree over 250,000 apps. Of those 250,000 apps, only 402 had some form of compatibility issue. And those compatibility issues are all the way from you're just using an outdated version and there's a newer mm-hmm. version that's compatible, through to we'll help you open up the hood and tinker with the code to actually get it working again. And so 402 out of 250,000, I think, is about, it's definitely less than 1%. It might be like 0.15%, something mm-hmm. like that. So that's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction. So first of all, that's really interesting data to show that, you know, that's a pretty big data set to say that the number of, back to maybe your original point of the transition from 7 to 10 being significantly smoother and easier mm-hmm. than that XP to 7, we can back that up with data, right? We can show that out of 250,000 plus apps, only 402 yep. had compatibility issues. So that's actually really good.
Yeah, and that's a very small number, especially I would assume that those 250,000 that came to people initially thought they had problems and then realized, hey, it's actually not that big of a deal.
Yeah, and it could be as simple as that those customers were trying to roll out a deployment and they were getting errors, that they were getting, you know, the deployment would not succeed, and maybe it wouldn't succeed mm-hmm. For a particular class of device, for a particular division in the group. Maybe it would get to some point and it would kind of stop, and they just didn't know. They just didn't have the analytics to understand why it wasn't working, why they were kind of failing in their deployment. Yeah. And, or maybe they had some limited data that said, hey, this is the cause of the problem. It's this app or it's this driver. But they just didn't have all the information they needed. And so coming to the Desktop App Assure program, that team was able to do much deeper analysis, much deeper investigation, and you know, identify the source of the issue, which again could be just an outdated app, all the way through to having to open up the code. And then Brad, I also have some Office 365 data here too. Ooh. So in that same time, they've talked to about 1,400 customers and passed over 130 million Office documents. I have kind of three stats here. So over 99% of all third-party commercial add-ons for Office were compatible with Office 365 Pro Plus. So less than 1% of add-ons had an issue. And macros that needed some kind of remediation or needed some kind of help, also a tiny amount. So less than 0.3% of macros needed some kind of remediation. But again, the team can help with that. So the data is showing that migration from 7 or Office Perpetual to 10 and Office 365 mm-hmm. is going to be so much smoother because those compatibility issues don't really exist. But if you do have one, we have this program called Desktop App Assure, and those guys will take care of you, and they will literally solve the problems that you have. That's their charter. That's what they do.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. And obviously links to everything we talk about today will be down below. But Nick, I want to pick your brain about
this is my little pantomimey move for where the Chiron-y thing. Actually, no, it'd be half me, half you, right?
Well, if I do it this way, then
yeah, there we go.
There you go.
In front of my microphone. There we go.
Centering the magical links that appear are always easier.
There's a Reddit subreddit where it's admittedly mostly sporting events, but it's mm-hmm. where a ref or an umpire does like some hand gesture, and purely through coincidence, some kind of animated thing happens.
Oh, it looks like it's magic.
So yeah, like a ref will like lift up a red card in the soccer, and the exact space where the red card is, something will be like, you know, superimposed over it, the FIFA logo or something like that. And So I was wondering if like, can we like sort of fake that? Like, can I just kind of like click my fingers?
Yeah.
And then that's when the Chiron appears, and we can just pretend that we kind of that wasn't planned, and it was just purely happenstance. How about that?
Yeah, it just did. Cool. That's how that's the magic of post production, right?
Beautiful. Beautiful.
So, Two other quick things here. So we've got, what happens, Nick, if you are on Windows 7 or you're dealing with that and you're in transition, you know, what is Microsoft's advice that as we approach this deadline, which is in January of 2020 and Windows 7 starts to reach end of support, what happens here if you can't fully migrate or what is going on in your life that doesn't allow that to happen?
Yeah, so there are going to be scenarios where a customer who or customers, excuse me, who have some dependency on Windows 7 are going to need to keep Windows 7 around. And there's kind of two sanctioned, I don't know if sanction is the right word, but there are certainly two paths that are certainly the ones that we recommend if you have to go down that path. The first is something called ESU, which is a paid service, which allows you to pay at a per device level for extended support updates for Windows 7 beyond January 14, 2020. So you can extend the life of Windows 7 with support from Microsoft beyond January 14, 2020, up to 3 years, but you pay for it. It is a paid service. It's paid per device. I believe the payment, the annual payments increase each year, and that's sort of intentional to really try and encourage you to move off of Windows 7. I don't. I think if you have a really hard dependency, we'll work with you to make sure you don't kind of feel like you're being kind of unfairly penalized. It's not meant to be punitive, but it is meant to be sort of encouraging. But I will say that's not a great solution. So first of all, you're paying money, so that's money that could be spent on something else. But at the end of the day, you're still on Windows 7, and Windows 7 when Windows 7 ends support on January 14 in 2020, it'll be 10 years old. And so if you're buying another year of support or 2 or 3 years support, you're going to be on 10, 11, 12, 13 year old software. You're not going to have that software. That's not going to, you know, even though you're paying for extra support, you're not getting the integration with OneDrive. You're not getting the integration with Azure Active Directory. You're not getting all the new security functionality that's baked into Windows 10. Yes, you can sort of piecemeal some of this stuff together, like you can add some things on. But at the end of the day, it is an outdated operating system that all you're doing is paying for extra security updates to make sure that if a vulnerability is found, our researchers and scientists and security analysts will develop a fix for it, and we'll kind of push it out. Then you will get access to that. But it's really not a great solution. Like, it's not, you know, in 2020 and 2021, 22, 23, the best Windows platform to be on is going to be Windows 10. Like, that's where you should be. This is only if you absolutely have to be on 7 for some very kind of very, very restrictive kind of reason. There is an ability to, as I said, purchase these end of support, extended support updates. The second option that we provide, which is maybe a little bit more interesting, is something called the Windows Virtual Desktop. Have you guys covered that?
Yes, we have. This was launched not too long ago, if I'm correct, right?
Yes, it was again, I think it may be about a year old, maybe 18 months. It's nothing revolutionary. It's really an evolution, I should say, of VDI, the virtual desktop infrastructure or virtual desktops. It's basically a new version of Windows Enterprise, or a kind of a special version of Windows Enterprise, a multi-user, multi-session version of Windows Enterprise that runs in Azure. And that's the Windows 10 part is that Windows Virtual Desktop allows you to run this multi-user, multi-session Windows 10 Enterprise Edition in Azure. But it also allows you to run Windows 7. So one thing you can do is, if you, again, have this dependency on Windows 7 for whatever reason, you can migrate your Windows 7 machines as virtual machines up into Windows and up into the Windows VD servers running in Azure. And so your users can migrate the devices to Windows 10 or whatever their platform mm-hmm. happens to be. They could actually be on Mac, they could be on Android, doesn't matter. And we want them to be on Windows, obviously, and Windows 10. But then they can remote into a Windows 7 VM that's hosted in Azure. And the reason why you would do this is that it is those Windows 7 VMs hosted in Azure as part of WVD service will continue to get security updates for the next 3 years. So you don't have to pay for those extra security updates. Those are actually gotcha. Included as part of the WVD service. Mm-hmm. However, you do need to pay for your Azure compute and Azure storage charges. So,
okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that's probably a better option than the Windows 7 extended security updates because mm-hmm. with Windows 7 ESU, you're actually keeping Windows 7 on your device. And so you're still limited in what that device yeah. can do because it's still running the Windows 7 operating system. Mm-hmm. With Windows Virtual Desktop, you can actually have your endpoints running a modern operating system, hopefully Windows 10, but it is cross-platform compatible, and then remote into your Windows 7 session as needed for a special case. And that Windows 7 VM is going to continue to get security updates for 3 years, which hopefully will give you extra time to work out how you update your workflow and move mm-hmm. off of Windows 7 dependency. So they're kind of the two sanctioned options.
Yep.
Buying the extended security updates, which again, I honestly think for most of the people listening to your podcast and reading the repetri that come to Throck.com, et cetera, I don't think that's a good solution for them. I think at the end of the day, their devices are still running Windows 7 actually on the endpoint. I think a better solution is to look at Windows Virtual Desktop and running Windows 7 mm-hmm. up in the Windows Virtual Desktop service on Azure.
Yep.
Just in order to kind of buy time, to get extra time to work out how you migrate entirely your workflow onto the modern platform.
Yeah, it definitely seems like it's a much more sustainable option given the scenario, right? That seems totally. Like the better route to go. So Nick, as we were talking right before we started podcasting here, as we shut down this episode, the back of the book, if you will, we're talking about names. And you were telling me something about Australia and how they violate names and make up new names and toss all convention aside.
Yeah, so I asked Brad if your given name was Bradley.
Yep.
And you said it was. I am Nick, but my given name is Nicholas.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that happens in Australia, and I think we probably borrowed this from the British, it's probably some kind of evolution of Cockneyism or something that made its way to the Australian shores, was that we like short kind of single syllable or two syllable at most names for things. There's a funny phenomenon called Cockney rhyming slang, which I won't talk about. You can look it up on Wikipedia. That's kind of a fun thing that we've adopted in Australia as well. That definitely came from ye olde England. But mm-hmm. another thing is, I think that we've adopted this kind of shortening name. So in high school, I was called Philo. My last name's Fillingham. That was too many syllables. And so friends shortened that to Philo. And it could have been Phil-la. Mm-hmm. A lot of the times those shortened nicknames will end in either an A or an O. So Sam's is an interesting one. I was trying to think, like, you'd be Samo. You might be Samo.
Samo.
So I think, first of all, we just ignore your first name.
Yeah.
We'd look straight to your family name, your surname, mm-hmm. and then we would shorten it wherever we can. And we would add an O or an A at the end of it. So, like, for example, anyone whose last name was McDonald, they're Macca. They're okay. definitely Macca. If your last name was Fitzgerald, you'd be probably Fitzy.
Fitzy.
Yeah. Or it could be Fitzo. Fitzy or Fitzo. So we want two syllables or less, and we're going to finish on on a vowel sound, and that's so I think you'd be Samo. Should I call you Samo?
You can call me whatever you want, Nick.
Samo, how does that kind of translate into the, where are you from? Milwaukee? No, something sounds like an M.
Cincinnati.
So if I called you Samo on the streets of Cincinnati, is someone going to think that I'm referring to a what? What does that sound like? Where's the confusion in calling you Samo on the streets of Cincinnati? Any?
I don't know if there would be any. I was trying.
I think you're Samo.
There's no major like establishment called Samo here.
There's no like Samo's Bar and Grill.
I don't
or
think so.
There's not like some abandoned hockey mascot called the Samo Slammer or something.
Samo Slammer. No.
You're Sammo.
Apparently, I am Sammo. I'm the only known Sammo in the Cincinnati tri-state region.
You know, I should have looked it up before the call. There's probably an internet Australian slang nickname generator. I bet you someone's done it where you type in your surname or something and it tells you how to shorten it and gives you options whether you're Sammo, Samma.
So I Googled it or binned it or used your favorite search engine. And Sammo, if I type just Sammo Cincinnati, there's an art institution called Sammo Lives or Sammo Lives.
Okay. I meant looking for not Sammo, but looking for the nickname generator. We'll look that up later.
Very, very cool. Nick, we very much appreciate you stopping by on this edition of the Enterprise Dish and giving me my official Australian slang name for next time I'm down under. And to everybody else, thanks for tuning in today, folks. You can find all the links and everything else down below or in line, as Nick likes to do. But we appreciate everyone stopping by. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you right back here next time.